Despite the treadmill of writing a humorous column every day for the Independent newspaper, Miles Kington still manages to read widely. Recently, he presented a selection of his favourite finds to an audience at the Watershed Media Centre in Bristol. With the help of readers Sheila Stiefel and Kerry Shale, he began the evening's entertainment with a confession.
About 15 years ago, the editor of a magazine rang me up to find out what book I was reading at bedtime. "Now, just go to your bedside table and tell me what's on it," he said. And I went, and I was slightly taken aback to find 20 books, all with bookmarks in. Though only the top two eventually appeared in the magazine. And this goes to show, I think, that I'm a fairly varied reader, but I have difficulty finishing books. In fact, I can distinctly remember that in one of them, which was a Simenon Maigret novel, I was actually getting further and further from the end. This was because every time I picked up the book, I'd forgotten the plot, so I had to go 6 or 7 pages back, and I only read on average about 3 pages at a time. So I was going backwards on average, and quite often characters would reappear who I could remember having been killed off. And I suppose eventually I must have got to the first page, which isn't a bad thing, because Simenon's opening pages are usually wonderful pieces of scene setting. But before you write the opening of your book, you have to think of a good title. Or at least a title, because it strikes me that many titles become good after the work has become famous. I love Raymond Chandler's writings, but when I think of his titles, I have to admit that as his publisher, I'd frown a bit at The Little Sister, The Lady in the Lake, or even The Big Sleep. The magic those titles have now has accrued to them in the interim. Chandler actually left behind a list of novel titles he was thinking of using but never did. Now, see if you think any of them is magical without a book.
The Man with a Shredded Ear.
The Porter Rose at Dawn.
Fair with some rain.
They Only Murdered Him Once.
The Diary of a Loud Check Suit.
A Night in the Icebox.
Stop screaming, it's me.
The Lady with the Truck.
Everyone says goodbye too soon.
Now, occasionally, titles get you into trouble. When the Marx Brothers planned to make a film called A Night in Casablanca, they received a stern letter from the makers of Casablanca, Warner Brothers, telling them to think of another title. Groucho Marx's reply showed that he didn't need much help from scriptwriters when it came to monologues.
Dear Warner Brothers, I just don't understand your attitude. Even if you plan on re-releasing your picture, I am sure that the average movie fan could learn in time to distinguish between Ingrid Bergman and Harpo. I don't know whether I could, but I certainly would like to try. You claim you own Casablanca, and that no one else can use that name without your permission. What about Warner Brothers? Do you own that too? You probably have the right to use the name Warner, but what about Brothers? Professionally, we were brothers long before you were. We were touring the sticks as the Marx Brothers when Vitaphone was still a gleam in the inventor's eye. And even before us, there have been other brothers. The Smith Brothers. The Brothers Karamazov. Dan Brothers, an outfielder with Detroit. And Brother Can You Spare a Dime? Now, this was originally Brothers Can You Spare a Dime, but this was spreading a dime pretty thin, so they threw out one brother, gave all the money to the other one, and whittled it down to Brother Can You Spare a Dime. Sincerely, Groucho Marx.
And much more in the same vein. Undeterred, Warner Brothers' legal department wrote back to ask Groucho what the plot was about.
Dear Warners, there isn't much I can tell you about the story. In it, I play a doctor of divinity who ministers to the natives and has a sideline hawks can openers and pea jackets to the savages along the Gold Coast of Africa. When I first meet Chico, he is working in a saloon selling sponges to barflies who are unable to carry their liquor. Harpo is an Arabian caddy who lives in a small Grecian urn on the outskirts of the city. As the picture opens, Porridge, a mealy-mouthed native girl, is sharpening some arrows for the hunt. Paul Hangover, our hero, is constantly lighting 2 cigarettes simultaneously. He is apparently unaware of the cigarette shortage. There are many scenes of splendor and fierce antagonisms and color. An Abyssinian messenger boy runs riot. Riot, in case you've never been there, is a small nightclub on the edge of town. There's a lot more I could tell you, but I don't want to spoil it for you. Cordially, Groucho Marx.
By now, the Warner lawyers must have realized that it wasn't much good playing by the rules, because Groucho didn't recognize any rules. But they plugged on. The storyline seemed obscure, they said. Could they have some more details? Groucho was glad to supply them.
Dear brothers, since I last wrote to you, I regret to say there have been some changes in the plot of our new picture, A Night in Casablanca. In the new version, I play Bordello, the sweetheart of Humphrey Bogart. Harpo and Chico are itinerant rug peddlers who are weary of laying rugs and enter a monastery just for a lark. This is a good joke on them, as there hasn't been a lark in the place for 15 years.
Across from this monastery, hard by a jetty, is a waterfront hotel, chock full of apple-cheeked damsels, most of whom have been barred by the Hayes office for soliciting. Harpo marries a hotel detective. Chico operates an ostrich farm. Humphrey Bogart's girl, Bordello, spends her last years in a Bacall house. This, as you can see, is a very skimpy outline. The only thing that can save us from extinction is a continuation of the film shortage. Fondly, Groucho Marx.
After that, not surprisingly, Warners gave up. I sometimes hear Alistair Cook on the radio going on about his favorite American writer, H.L. Mencken, but the sales of his books in this country never increase. This is for the very good reason that no books of his are published in this country. Now, he's also my favorite American writer, and I'm just mentioning his unavailability now to stop you rushing out tomorrow to the bookshops. I first encountered Mencken when I was about 17, being attracted by the title of a second-hand volume in an old bookshop in Wrexham, my hometown, Selected Prejudices. It was a series of essays in which he lashed out with wit and polemic against God, women, men, opera, America, Europe, poetry. Anyone who writes poetry after the age of 24, he said, had arrested development. But rather than offer you a bit of his witty polemic, I'm going to offer you a bit from his autobiographical writings, when he's reminiscing about his native Baltimore and the amateur orchestra he belonged to, which was led by a man called Willie Woolcott.
But the greatest of all Willie Woolcott's inspirations was his plan to play the first 8 Beethoven symphonies in order, with only brief halts for refreshments between them. He omitted the 9th only because the club's singing section at that time lacked castrati, and, in fact, consisted of but 2 men, both of them low, growling basses. We had excellent arrangements of the first 8 symphonies, and after debating the bold project for 2 or 3 years, resolved at last to give it a whirl. This must have been in 1922 or thereabouts, when the club had the largest membership in its history, including a great many bold and reckless men, some of them aviators or ex-marines. Willie not only supplied the idea, he also proposed to supply the scene. His house in a dense wood near Baltimore, with no neighbors within earshot, and the refreshments. It seemed a reasonable arrangement, and so we fell to at 4 o'clock of a summer afternoon. The first symphony was child's play to us, and we turned it off in record time, with a pause of only 10 minutes afterward. By 6 o'clock, we had also finished the second, and then we stopped for cocktails and dinner. After dinner, there was some relaxation, and we dallied a bit with some excellent malt liquor, so that it was 8 o'clock before we tackled the Eroica. It began so badly that we played the first movement twice, but after that it picked up momentum, and by 9:30 we had finished it. Then we paused again, this time for sandwiches, a walk in the woods, it was a lovely moonlit night, and another resort to the malt. But at 11:30, or maybe a little later, we were back in the trenches, and the fourth was begun. For some reason or other, it went even worse than the Eroica, though it actually makes much less demand on the technique, and the clock must have been near to 1 a.m. when we decided finally that it had been done well enough. Our struggles with it had naturally tired us, so we decided to knock off for an hour and find out what the malt had to offer in way of encouragement. This hiatus, unhappily, was a fatal one, for when the time came to resume the hullabaloo, it was discovered the 2 of the members had sneaked off for home, and the 2 more were so sound asleep that we could not arouse them without risk of hurting them. Thus, the C minor was begun under unfavorable circumstances. And by the time it was over, the band was reduced to what amounted to a mere fragment, and the 4-hand piano was making so much noise that the other surviving instruments were barely audible. The pastoral followed at once, but how it was done, I can't say, for I fell asleep myself somewhere in the scherzo, and by the time Willie got me back on the piano bench, the end had been reached, and there was a debate going on about number 7. It was now nearly 5 a.m., and the east was rosy with the dawn. One faction, it appeared, was in favor of giving up and going home. Another insisted that a round of ham and eggs and a few beers would revive us enough to take us to the end. As to what actually happened, there are 2 legends. The official story, inscribed by Willie upon the scrolls of the club, is that we tackled the 7th, banged through it in circus time, and then dispatched the 8th. A rump account says that we blew up in the middle of the 7th, leaped to the 8th, blew up again, and were chased out by our host, assisted by his hunting dogs. According to this rump account, but 3 performers were left at the end, the primo pianist, 1 fiddler, and a man trying to play a basset horn. My own feeling is that in such bizarre matters, precise facts are only intrusions. If we actually played the 8 symphonies, then no other group of musicians has ever done it, on this or any other earth. And if we only tried, then no one else has ever tried.
Now, it may have occurred to you by this point that if I had 20 varied books on my bedside table, you're not getting much variety here, because we seem to be in for a diet of humour. Well, why not? This is the festive season, after all. But humour is still the kind of writing that most fascinates me, because in a way I'm still an outsider to the game, even though I make my living from it. I didn't come to humour through any of the usual channels, like being small and bullied at school, or being Jewish, or being small, Jewish, and bullied at school, like Woody Allen. God, how I envied him. I just admired humorists desperately and wanted to be like them, without ever asking myself if I had the talent for it. I wanted to know, for instance, why Ogden Nash could write pretend verse that didn't even try to scan and make it funny, whereas people who imitated him, from Basil Boothroyd to, on one occasion, Anthony Burgess, couldn't. Here's a poem called The Trouble with Women is Men.
A husband is a man who, 2 minutes after his head touches the pillow, is snoring like an overloaded omnibus. Particularly on those occasions when, between the humidity and the mosquitoes, your own bed is no longer a bed, but an insomnibus. And if you turn on the light for a little reading, he is sensitive to the faintest gleam. But if by any chance you were asleep and he wakeful, he is not slow to rouse you with a complaint that he can't close his eyes. What about slipping downstairs and freezing him a cooling dish of pistachio or ice cream? His touch with a bottle opener is sure. But it cannot help you get a tight dress over your head without catching 3 hooks and a button in your coiffure. Nor can he so much as wash his ears without leaving an inch of water on the bathroom linoleum. But if you mention it, you evoke not a promise to splash no more, but a mood of deep melancholium. Indeed, each time he transgresses, your chance of correcting his faults grows lesser, because he produces either a maddeningly logical explanation or a look of martyrdom which leaves you, instead of him, feeling the remorse of the transgressor. Such are husbandly foibles, but there are moments when a foible ceases to be a foible. Next time you ask for a glass of water, and when he brings it, you have a needle almost threaded, and instead of setting it down, he stands there holding it out to you. Just kick him fairly hard in the stomach. You will find it thoroughly enjoyable.
Now, women have a pretty good sense of humour, as they'd have to living in a man's world, but is usually too sensible to have any truck with fantasy or nonsense. Their speciality is observation of the real world, the sharpness of Catherine Whitehorn or Dorothy Parker. So I'm delighted to watch the progress of Stephanie Kalman, a young English writer who seems to combine acute observation with a war correspondent's excitement at being the middle of the male-female divide, and also with being very funny. Her first book was rather appealingly called Gentlemen Prefer My Sister. And her most recent is Dressing for Breakfast, where even in the introduction she strides over the reader with Doc Martens when she says,
"Men move in mysterious ways. They're the only sex who think foreplay is watching the TV close down. They're also the only other sex, full stop. So we spend our lives eating with them, sleeping with them, and going out to buy dustbin liners. Sometimes going out to buy dustbin liners can be the most fulfilling part."
That has the feel of the good stand-up comedian about it, and the book is actually full of good one-liners like, people ask when they're going to invent an oral contraceptive for men. Haven't they heard of Carlsberg Special Brew? But sex is almost old hat these days. Here she is on a really taboo area.
"I have a large choice in the matter, but I devote most of my negative energy to my legs. In an average day, I would say the time spent in consideration of their undesirability is about 11%. It's not the shape, or even so much the length, although their brevity does give me a walk like Donald Duck's. It's just that they're so hairy. Now, before you say you understand, I'm not talking about soft little wisps of down tickling my knee. I mean, when it comes to winter, they're very well insulated, thank you very much. You know how the arm of a Greek waiter looks when it's stretched out, handing you a kebab? People always think I'm exaggerating. They say sympathetically, 'Oh, I know, mine too,' and lift up the leg of their trousers to show me the 3 individual hairs I can't even see. They advise me to use cream. You know, it destroys the hairs below skin level and they grow back weaker each time. You should try it. Of course I've tried it. It was never enough. An economy-sized tube got used up doing the test patch. The only way for it to have had any useful effect would have been to get it sprayed on with hoses by men in waterproof capes. So I use shears. I get them from a gardening catalogue with special lawn trimming attachments for going round the ankles. Frankly, it's not just the legs. The rest of me is nearly as bad. When I say I like men with hairy chests, I mean hairier than mine. Personally, I blame it on the pill. I started taking it when the hormone doses were still pretty high, and it worked very well. It stopped you from getting pregnant by turning you into a man. Some of my friends were on it at the same time. One of them's still a man. Well, she found she got served in pubs faster, so she decided to stay that way.
If women humorists are not plentiful, they certainly outnumber another minority, French humorists. I spent 3 years at university studying French literature, and although I quite often smiled dutifully and said, "Nice one, Marcel," as another shaft of wit flew past, I never really laughed out loud at all, except at Voltaire, who could time a gag better than anyone else in the world in the 18th century. Then, shortly after I left, I encountered Alphonse Allais, who was Paris's favourite humorist in about 1900, and has been forgotten ever since. I so fell in love with his stuff that the very first book I ever did was a translation of a selection of his pieces for Chateau and Windus. I'll get to read this one. At Christmas time, about 3 years ago, I found myself detained by chance in a small prison in Yorkshire, awaiting trial on charges of theft, swindling and blackmail. Thereby hangs a long and shameful story, which I'd rather not go into. It brings back painful memories. It wasn't so much being in prison that upset me, it was being there at that particular season, because I've always loved Christmas. Christmas. Time for all children to gather around the fireplace and enjoy themselves. Time for all grown-ups to gather under the mistletoe, ditto. And there I was, I who had been invited to spend the Christmas holiday in the Faroe Isles, with a missionary and his family. All my readers must know what it's like to be in prison. But how many of you have ever been in prison in snowy weather? I know nothing worse. All sound vanishes utterly. Sweet sound, the only thing that keeps you in touch with the outside world. When snow falls, you can no longer see or hear anything. Then Christmas Eve arrived. It became dark. I couldn't bring myself to go to bed. The village church bells were all muffled by the snow, muted by the distance, and so evocative I felt my eyes brimming with tears. I always feel like crying when I hear far-off bells in the countryside. "Come in," I said, startled out of my reverie. Somebody had knocked at the door. It opened, and in came the jailer's daughter, a pink and white girl of about 15, carrying a little basket in one hand and a large spray of mistletoe in the other.
"Good evening, sir,"
she said. "Good evening, miss," I replied, also in English. And she went on,
"Well, do you remember the last time we met?"
"Of course," I said. One of Kate Greenaway's books, wasn't it?"
"No, never."
"A drawing by Robert Caldicott, then?"
"No, wrong again."
I fell silent.
"Have you really forgotten?"
she said, crossly.
"It was in London last year, don't you remember? You saved me from certain death. I was walking across Trafalgar Square when suddenly one of the bronze lions charged furiously at me, roaring loudly. I ran away as fast as I could. You were sitting on the top deck of a passing omnibus. You leapt down and with one powerful arm snatched me from the clutches of the predatory beast. Cheated of its prey, the lion shrunk back to his normal place and struck once again the artistic pose the sculptor had designed for him."
I racked my brain. But I could recall nothing remotely like that which ever happened to me. She was quite firm, though.
"You must remember. It was the Bull and Gate bus. You were on your way to see your friend Lombardi at the Villa Chiavenna."
Faced with such a wealth of circumstantial detail, I had to give in and agree. So she took a large plum pudding out of her basket, together with several bottles of English ale, and we proceeded to make merry. When dawn came, she slipped away, taking with her my heart and the empties. Ever since then, I've often tried to remember taking part in that curious episode in Trafalgar Square. I've always failed. Nor, to tell the truth, can I remember ever having been in prison in Yorkshire. Is it not curious how in this life we forget so much? I don't know what the French for shaggy dog story is, but they were doing them before we did. Now, I like Flann O'Brien for many of the same reasons that I like Alphonse Allais. They both have a slightly irresponsible sense of humour. They both have a black side to them. They both would have lived a lot longer if it hadn't been for all the drinking. And they both liked dreaming up mad inventions. There was a very good Life of O'Brien out recently, and I read a very serious review of it which said that if only O'Brien had written fewer columns for the Irish Times, and if only he'd had a more international outlook, and if only he'd devoted himself to art and novels, he would have been a more fulfilled man. And what a load of nonsense. The only thing I have against Flann O'Brien is that he wrote his humour under the name of Miles Nagopoline. The best anthology of his stuff is called The Best of Miles, which always makes me feel unaccountably jealous. But here, anyway, is a chunk of the inventive side of the great man.
The Miles Nagopoline Central Research Bureau is working night and day on an invention that may mean the end of civilization as we know it. Again, it is a new kind of ink, but nothing so footling as the other kind that disappears off checks a few hours after you've written your signature with it. No, no, sir, this is something bigger. And when perfected, will lead to a worldwide revolution, the end of which no man can foresee. It is provisionally called Trink, and looks for all the world like the ordinary black ink you can buy for tuppence. Trink, however, is a very special job. When put on paper and dried, it emits a subtle alcoholic vapor, which will hang over the document in an invisible, odorless cloud for several days. A person perusing such a document is surrounded by this cloud. The vapor is drawn in with the breath, condenses on the mucus tract, gradually finds its way to the stomach, and is absorbed in the blood. Intoxication ensues, mild or acute, according to how much reading is done. Considerable difficulty has been encountered in perfecting the invention, not because of any major snag, but because our research workers emerged from the laboratory day after day in a hopeless state of inebriation and were unable to give any coherent account of their experience. One of our best men has had to be put away. Absenteeism is rampant among others who cannot face two consecutive days' work owing to the paralyzing hangover that is conferred by the first. This difficulty, however, is being taken care of. Soon a new type of gas mask will be available, and the great work will go on. Later, when Trink has been perfected, the whole idea is to print the Irish Times with it. You will then get something more than a mere newspaper for your threepence. You get a lightning pick-me-up, not only for yourself and your family, but for everybody that travels in your bus. Any time you feel depressed, all you need to do is read the leading article. If you want a whole night out, you just get down to the small ads.
Talk of modern British humorists always comes around sooner or later to Beachcomber. But although I love J.B. Morton's writing, I always think it's a shame that everyone forgets the man who actually started the Beachcomber column, who was D.B. Wyndham Lewis, not to be confused with Wyndham Lewis. In fact, probably so as not to be confused with Wyndham Lewis, D.B. later changed his name to Timothy Shy and wrote a great many wonderful columns under that name. So here, just as a sample of his slightly ornate but rather fetching style, is a piece he wrote in 1931 called Hail and Farewell, in which an old dying man is asked to pass on one final message. The old man opens his mouth and, with a great effort, starts handing out advice for the next hour or two.
Never order thick soup. Never read books recommended by rich women. Never call a hound a dog. Never wear spats with brown shoes. Never live in Surrey. Never hazard a light observation in the presence of the Scots. Never refer to realities in the presence of the English. Never forget that on the whole it is more dangerous to do good to one's fellow men than to do harm. Never forget that if a fact is not printed on good, thick, expensive paper in clear, solid type, the English will not believe it. Never drink cocktails. Never collect stamps. Never forget to assure a woman that she is unlike any other woman in the world, which she will believe, after which you may proceed to deal with her as with any other woman in the world. Never motor to Brighton. Never take a Pullman train to Brighton. Never go to Brighton. Never forget that the following take themselves seriously. Politicians, vegetarians, advanced thinkers, and those in the care of warders and male nurses. Never forget that fat men, for all their fair, rounded exterior, are often cunning and malignant like the rest. Never talk when you can listen. Never listen when you can read. Never read without meditation. Never.
At this point, the old man folded his pale and finely shaped hands, relapsed into meditation, and soon afterwards passed away without adding any more to his advice. He left £207, 8 shillings and tenpence. I suppose I shouldn't really pass over Beachcombe without quoting something of his, so I've gone for my favourite poem that he wrote. In fact, it may be my favourite poem of all time.
I knew a child called Alma Brent, completely destitute of brains, whose principal accomplishment was imitating railway trains. When ladies called at Sunnyside, Mama, to keep the party clean, would say with pardonable pride, "Now, Alma, do the 6:15. The child would grunt and snort and puff with weird contortions of the face, and when the guests had had enough, she'd cease with one last wild grimace. One day her jovial Uncle Paul cried, "Come on, Alma, do your worst," and challenged thus before them all, she did the 4:19... and burst.
I have a bit of a weakness for thinking that the slightly neglected writer is better than he really is, just as the little village or the restaurant you discover for yourself always seems better than the one in the travel guide, which is probably why I came to Alley and D.B. Wyndham Lewis. In the same way, you might be surprised to hear that in all the time I worked at Punch, which are the 13 longest years of my life, the writer I liked most of my contemporaries was not one of the names like Basil Boothroyd or Alan Corran. It was Alexander Freighter. Now, Freighter is now a big travel man on The Observer and does books about rivers and trains and seaplanes. But there was a time when he wrote most evocative, haunting pieces of humour. In fact, when I was first asked to do this programme, my initial immediate reaction was, I must find Freighter's piece about himself and the giant clam.
Recently, while traversing a Fijian reef at low tide, looking for a species of rare and valuable shell, a bite from which is supposed to induce a coronary thrombosis in horses, I got my foot caught in a giant clam. My first reaction was one of stupefied disbelief. Staring down, I caught a glimpse of myself in the still water, complexion chalky, lip trembling, eyes filling with tears as I tried to discern what it was that had me in its grip. Could it be a shark? These being equatorial waters, tepid as soup, that was the first thought that sprang to mind, but I discounted it at once. I had been seized by something with gums, and the mouth I had stepped into could have accommodated a small dog. Scrabbling at the water, I saw my pale shank anchored in a bulging mollusk, big as an airline bag, so I set about staying calm and deciding what to do. It didn't hurt much. There was considerable pressure, of course, but little actual pain. I had felt worse in tight shoes. For this, I had to thank Mrs. Mooney, manageress of the Sandy Bay Resort Hotel, an airy beachside hostelry a quarter of a mile away, hidden by mangroves, who had insisted I wear stout, reinforced boots to protect myself from the razor-sharp coral. Unable to withdraw my foot from the boot, I fell to wondering, assuming the thing was already at table, just how giant clams ate. Did they suck? Or chew, or lick, or what? I watched it for signs of appetite, but it remained inert, offering no clue. The tide, tugged by the absent moon, was soon lapping about my waist. I bent to the clam and tried to lift it, but it had soldered itself firmly to the ocean floor. Then I attempted with my hands to prise its jaws open. Then I kicked it with my other foot and nearly drowned. Time passed. Small fish swam up to inspect me. A seahorse approached and started grazing about the hairs of my legs. A baby squid made love to my knee. I glared down at the clam and gave it another mighty swipe with my second boot, at once proving that its tiny Stone Age brain possessed some residual cunning. It tightened its grip. My leg was growing numb, and my mind swam with images of my skeleton, still here years hence, swaying and tinkling in the currents. Then, from the south, I saw a canoe approaching. I waved and yelled, and it came towards me at speed. The man in it wished to sell me some mangoes. "I've been trapped by a giant clam," I told him.
Very cheap, very juicy, he intoned.
The bloody thing is quietly nourishing itself on my foot, I said. I am being consumed like a plate of pretzels.
Frowning severely, he backed off. During the next hour, two more canoes appeared. One contained a bored girl selling sugar cane, the other an estate agent, who tried to interest me in a nearby cottage. The present owner was selling because of the bushman who appeared from time to time and ate her thatched roof. We were unable to agree on a price, but he at least understood my predicament. He paddled off, promising to notify the authorities. Nobody came from the authorities, but eventually a man came from the press. He was a small and dapper Indian, with a handkerchief tucked in his sleeve and a silk umbrella to protect him from the sun.
What ho! He said, raising a limp hand. A chap told us of your plight, hoping to earn the $5 he will get if we use the story, and I have notified Mrs. Mooney at the hotel. Name, please. Age, profession.
I supplied these details, and he wrote them down.
And your leg, does it hurt?
Yes, I said, it's starting to throb.
Oh, well, if you don't mind, he said, I shall wait to take your picture until the pain is almost unendurable. Our readers will expect to see you thrashing around a bit. My name is Chowdhury, by the way. Actually, I am the cookery man at the paper. You are British, I gather. Oh, dear, dear me, what a mess you people are in. Tell me, old man, is it true that the Wilson cabinet is held in such low esteem that its members walk into number 10 with their heads in paper bags?
I was just about to assure him that this was indeed the case when the launch from the Sandy Bay Resort Hotel swung into view. It contained the ample, gourd-shaped figure of Mrs. Mooney, accompanied by her 16-stone gardener. She cut the engine.
Stand quite still, she said,
as the gardener, holding a crowbar as nonchalantly as a chopstick, hopped out and started whacking steadily at the base of the clam. Mr. Chowdhury took some pictures, and then struck up a conversation with Mrs. Mooney, who was watching proceedings with an expression of extreme anxiety. When the gardener had cut the clam adrift, he dumped it, with me attached, in the launch, and then, with a small axe, proceeded to break the thing open and free my foot.
Careful, careful, murmured Mrs. Mooney,
and I smiled at her gratefully. I was released before we hit the beach, and that night, still limping and supporting myself on a kind of shrub, I understood the reason for her concern. A party was held, and the pièce de résistance was the clam, baked in its shell by Mr. Chowdhury, and served with hot buttered yams. I took one mouthful, was sick, and shortly afterwards made my way back to England.
My father could never remember more than four lines of any poem, a talent which I've inherited. But he found an ingenious solution to this. He never memorized any poem longer than four lines long. So not unnaturally, his favourite poet was Harry Graham, whose brief, ruthless rhymes for heartless homes quite cheered up my childhood with its remorselessly cheerful catalogue of murder and accidental death.
L'enfant glacé. When baby's cries grew hard to bear, I popped him in the frigid air. I never would have done so if I'd known that he'd be frozen stiff. My wife said, George, I'm so unhappy. Our darling's now completely frappé.
One of my favourite all travel books is Eleanor Bronze, Life and Other Punctures, which is an account of a bicycle trip to England and France. Eleanor Bronze must be one of the worst bicyclists ever born, because I seem to remember that every time she had a puncture, she abandoned the machine and either bought another one or went home by train. For a travel writer, she didn't actually get very far, but I've always thought that movement in travel is a bit overrated. Life and Other Punctures is actually a chance for Eleanor Bronze to tell us about her life while pretending to travel. And one of the bits I always remember best is her description of how she learnt to swim as a child.
I was taught to swim, or rather I was given my first lessons, one summer holiday in Swanage, the big hotel at the end of town with its own little beach and private pool. Even in those days of post-war austerity, they lit up the pool at night with cunning floodlights along the sides below the water level. It was very pretty. Into this alluring rectangle, a few late-night adventurers would occasionally jump. But for the most part, the nightly illuminations were pure decoration, a jolly status symbol that added unquestionably to the hotel's many attractions. But whether the guests availed themselves of it or not, the pool became, each evening, the last playground of a thousand winged and crawling things. In the few hours between the natural dousing of the sun in the sea and the switching off of the artificial illuminations of the pool, there was time for half the insect population of Dorset to learn of this continuing source of light and to buzz to the spot there joyfully to plunge to sodden depths. Every morning the pool lay like the field of Waterloo under the floating corpses. Not an inviting prospect for the early morning swimmer, as the hotel administrators did not fail to realize. A man was employed to come out every morning with a great wooden rake and comb the surface of the water. This he did with graceful, rhythmic, sweeping strokes, clearing the frail cadavers away from the center to line the little-used edges of the pool. Little-used. Here it was that, when he was done, I duly made my appearance to meet my instructor for my daily tuition. I remember the man or woman not at all. Only the grisly horror of each hour. His or her method was to suspend me over a canvas hoop so that I should have the impression of floating and generally get the feel of swimming. Small wonder, therefore, that the feel of swimming is to me the feel of 100 tiny dead things, moths and flies and straggling daddy long legs, bobbing against my clenched mouth, and if I forgot myself so far as to open that to protest or for air, bobbing right into my mouth and up my nostrils. I did eventually learn to swim, but only one stroke, the breast stroke, which I find so boring that only fear prevents me falling asleep as I swim and sinking like a stone.
The New Statesman once had a competition for the best found poem. That is, something which is not intended as proper writing, but actually reads well by accident. And a friend of mine, Geoffrey Wheatcroft, told me he was certain he was going to win it, as he'd spotted something in his new diary which made a wonderful poem. It was the little sheet of stickers you get at the end. You can tear it out, put each one on the right day. Before you tear it, it actually makes a poem which reads, "Today is my father's birthday. Today is my mother's birthday. Today is my wife's birthday. Today is my husband's birthday. Today. Today. Today." So, encouraged by that, I'm going to try a found short story on you. It's rather sad, actually, but the writer is anonymous, and the book is called The Collins Italian Phrasebook. There are no towels in the room. The room is too noisy. The light is not working. The air conditioning is not working. I cannot open the window. The heating is not working. I cannot turn the heating off. The lock is broken. There is no hot water. The wash basin is dirty. There is no plug in the wash basin. There is no toilet paper. We will be leaving tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I would like the bill, please. Do you accept traveller's checks? Can you have my luggage brought down? Can you order me a taxi? Thank you. We enjoyed our stay. Well, that's nearly it. There are lots of humorous writers I'd like to have included, especially Richmore Crompton, whose William books are still unbeatable, I think. There are lots of old favourite comic authors I went back to find, to my consternation, they were no longer funny at all. But the piece I want to end up with is not by a famous writer at all. In fact, it's not even by a writer. It's by the once very famous American comedian Shelley Berman, who spent much of his life in hotels and was eventually driven to write, from bitter experience, a book about life in hotels. I don't think it was ever published in England, but when I went back to it for this programme, I was relieved to find that it worked as well as I thought it had done. And I've chosen an exchange of letters between Berman and the hotel staff about his soap supply, partly to give Kerry and Sheila a chance to do a few voices together, though I have a small bit part in this. Partly because I've only ever read it on the page, and I'm looking forward to hearing it done properly by proper actors.
Dear maid, please do not leave any more of those little bars of soap in my bathroom, since I have brought my own bath-sized dial soap. Please remove the 6 unopened little bars from the shelf under the medicine chest and another 3 in the shower soap dish. They're in my way. Thank you. S. Berman.
Dear room 635, I am not your regular maid. She will be back tomorrow, Thursday, from her day off. I took the 3 hotel soaps out of the shower soap dish as you requested. The 6 bars on your shelf I took out of your way and put on top of your Kleenex dispenser in case you should change your mind. This leaves only the 3 bars I left today, which is my instructions from the management, is to leave 3 soaps daily. I hope this is satisfactory. If anything else comes up, please call Mrs. Carham in the linen room. Kathy, relief maid.
Dear maid, I hope you are my regular maid.
Apparently, Kathy did not tell you about my note to her concerning the little bars of soap. When I got back to my room this evening, I found you had added three little camés to the shelf under my medicine cabinet. I'm going to be here in the hotel for 2 weeks and have brought my own bath-sized dial, so I won't need those six little camés, which are now on the shelf. They're in my way when shaving, brushing teeth, etc. Please remove them. S. Berman.
Dear Mr. Berman, my day off was last Wednesday, so the relief maid left three hotel soaps, which we are instructed by the management. I took the six soaps which were in your tray on the shelf and put them in the soap dish where your dial was. I put the dial in the medicine cabinet for your convenience. I didn't remove the three complimentary soaps which are always placed inside the medicine cabinet for all new check-ins and which you did not object to when you checked in last Monday. Also, I did place three hotel soaps on your shelf as per my instructions from management, since you left no instructions to the contrary. Please let me know if I can be of further assistance or call the linen room. Her name is Mrs. Corm. Have a pleasant stay. Your regular maid, Dottie.
Dear Mr. Berman, the assistant manager, Mr. Ken Satter, informed me this AM that you called him last evening and said you were unhappy with your maid service. I have assigned a new girl to your room. If you have any future complaints, please contact me so I can give it my personal attention. Call extension 1108 between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Thank you. Elaine Carmen, housekeeper.
Dear Miss Carmen, it is impossible to contact you by phone since I leave the hotel for business at 7:45 a.m. and don't get back before 5:30 or 6 p.m. That's the reason I called Mr. Cancetta last night. You were already off duty. I only asked Mr. Cancetta if he could do anything about those little bars of soap. I do not want a new maid. The new maid you assigned me must have thought I was a new check-in today, since she left another three bars of hotel soap in my medicine cabinet, along with her regular delivery of three bars on the bathroom shelf. In just 5 days here, I have accumulated 24 little bars of soap. I am beginning to dread the next 9 days. Why are you doing this to me? S. Berman!
Dear Mr. Berman, your maid Kathy has been instructed to stop delivering soap to your room and remove the extra soaps. If I can be of further assistance, please call extension 1108 between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Thank you, Elaine Carman, housekeeper.
Dear Mr. Kinsetta, my bath-sized dial is missing. Every bar of soap was taken from my room, including my own bath-sized dial. I came in late last night and had to call the bellhop to bring me a bar of soap so I could take a shower. He brought me four little cashmere bouquets. S. Berman.
Dear Mr. Berman, I have informed our housekeeper, Elaine Carmine, of your soap problem. I cannot understand why there was no soap in your room, since our maids are instructed to leave three bars of soap each time they service a room. The situation will be rectified immediately. Please accept my apologies for the inconvenience. If you prefer cashmere bouquet to camé, please contact Mrs. Camine on extension 1108. Thank you, Martin Kinsetta, assistant manager.
Mrs. Carmen, just a short note to bring you up to date on my latest soap inventory. As of today, I possess, on shelf under medicine cabinet, 18 camés in 4 stacks of 4 and 1 stack of 2. On bedroom dresser, 1 stack of 3 cashmere bouquet, 1 stack of 4 hotel size bath size ivory, 8 camés in 2 stacks of 4. In shower soap dish, 6 camés, very moist. On northeast corner of tub, 1 cashmere bouquet, slightly used. On northwest corner of tub, 6 camés in 2 stacks of 3. Please ask Kathy, when she services my room, to make sure the stacks are neatly piled and dusted. Also, please advise her that stacks of more than 4 have a tendency to tip. May I suggest that my bedroom windowsill is not in use and will make an excellent spot for future soap deliveries? One more item. I have purchased another bar of bath-sized dial, which I am keeping in the hotel vault in order to avoid future misunderstandings. S. Berman.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Miles Kington. The readers were Kerry Shale and Sheila Stiefel. The producer in Bristol was Kate Whitehead.